Welcome to another edition of Barbarians at the Gate. I'm Jeremiah Jenny, broadcasting more or less at ground level from the Chaoyang district of Beijing, here in the office, home, and studio of my co-host, David Moser. David, how are you doing?
It's good, except this is kind of a sad day. I mean, it's raining outside. It should be spring by now, and yet I'm wearing a coat. It's kind of cold. Lots of crazy stuff happening in the world, and this may be our last podcast in Beijing for a while.
Well, it is raining. It is kind of a cloudy day, although my dog died last Friday, so any day that doesn't happen by comparison is an awesome day. But I am also, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that this is probably the last time we're going to do this across the table here in Beijing, at least for a little while.
Right.
You know, as many, if not both, our regular listeners know, I'm going to be relocating to Geneva, Switzerland in about 12 hours. And, you know, this is it's a change for me. But also, a lot of people are kind of like thinking of this as if I'm going off to sea on an ice floe. My wife has professional and personal connections to Beijing. I have professional and personal connections to Beijing. I'm perfectly open to coming back, you know, when necessary and even often, provided they let me.
Yeah. You're free to stay here in my house here. I have a spare bedroom. And
yeah,
the sheets are clean. We cleaned them several years ago. No one slept in them since, so they should be still clean.
Dave B&B. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't feel like I'm like, it's completely goodbye. But yeah, for the time being, you know, we're going to be out of the country. And that, it makes me think a little bit about what is this going to sound like now that I will be just another guy who used to live in China with a podcast, and that is definitely not an endangered species. Guy who used to live in China on themic.com.
That's right. Well, yes, that's right. But you're not just any guy who used to live in China. You're a guy who, when you go abroad, you take a lot of China in your head with you wherever you go, and that's sort of the same thing as being in China. So, I mean, you're certainly able to keep in touch with it. And don't forget, our podcast started inauspiciously online for the two of us because we started this foolhardy venture at the height of COVID, or at the very beginning of COVID. We didn't know how long this was going to go on. I think our first few episodes were all online because we couldn't be in the same place.
You were in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I was in New York first, then Oklahoma, and the internet worked in both places, so...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and you can make a good point. I mean, you know, everyone who lives here, we keep China in our head, sometimes in our lungs, mostly in our livers.
Blood. Yeah, right.
But yeah, I mean, there is that. But it is kind of, I'm thinking about, like, you know, what do you do with a podcast that for the last 4 years has been about China? And I think even though that wasn't our intention in the beginning, because of COVID and everyone leaving, we became one of the few English language podcasts that was being recorded by people who were here,
mm-hmm,
especially
right,
during COVID. And I struggle to think, you know, okay, going forward, what does that mean? Because watching China from thousands of miles away is certainly doable, particularly in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you and I know better, I think, than most, that the longer you're away, the harder it becomes to really get the nuance, the granular level of detail,
mm-hmm,
of what's going on here. And even though I plan to be coming back periodically, I don't know if like 2 or 3 weeks here and there make up for the experience of just the day-to-day existence, mm-hmm, of being, in my case, you know, the only random white guy in a complex of about 3,000 people who all know my daily life intimately.
Yeah. Well, don't forget that you are a historian, and so there are a lot of other aspects of China besides what's happening right now on the ground and what taxicab drivers are complaining about, right? Beijing will miss you in that way because you've been a mainstay here for so many years doing Beijing walks, taking innumerable student groups through the Forbidden City, out of Beijing, and, you know, various regions. You worked with study abroad programs, since you came. You've been doing things in academia, right? So Beijing will miss you in that respect. That's you as a link to China history, especially in Beijing. You were an invaluable resource, but you will be back, and academia is still happening. In a minute, I think I'll mention, give a few.
Is it happening, David?
Well,
is it happening?
Funny you should ask. I might as well say it now. We've done a lot of kvetching on this broadcast about the deterioration of academic ties between the PRC and the USA, especially, but in foreign countries in general, and sort of bemoaning the loss of the programs that we used to teach for, and also the loss of academic freedom in the programs that still exist. So this we've complained about this for since we started. But it struck me that the other day that in the last few months, really, and then certainly in the last year, there have been a sort of a groundswell of awareness and sort of, I would say, outreach at all levels on the American side and on the Chinese side that sort of reveal a kind of panicked realization in academia that this is one area that we don't want to decouple. And especially in China, because there's no lack of Chinese presence in American universities, 300,000 students there at all levels. The problem is here. Chinese academia, as we've talked about a lot, is painfully aware of the fact that they cannot be world-class universities unless they have international exchange and foreign students and foreign faculty here, you know, engaging in academic interplay and exchange. And so there's a sort of a panic mode. So here are just some things that I just jotted down that had just came one after the other. First was Xi Jinping a few months ago, last year at some point, suddenly saying that he wanted to bring 50,000 American students to China in the next 5 years. And he stressed American students, or at least that's what he said, right? That's quite a statement. And it sort of energized a lot of Chinese academia, because if he says it, that means perhaps there's money behind it. The other thing was just recently when Janet Yellen came and he met with these business people, you know, including Graham Allison, for example. He met with Graham Allison and he said this amazing thing. He said, you know, we should keep alive the U.S.-China relationship because I am in you and you are in me. 你中有我，我中有你. That's a Chinese saying, which is sounds really Roma, sort of very, very sickly sweet. But he said that, you know. So this is a kind of lots of little sprouts of new programs, short term programs coming to fruition. There's a new short term summer programs at Peking University. They call it Deep Dive, which they stole from the Schwarzman program, I think. The Beijing Foreign Studies University is doing another kind of short-term program that has, you know, travel and lectures and all this kind of stuff. The university I'm working for is trying to get a two-year master's program going here. Good luck with that. It's going to be a real struggle. One of the sort of most hardline hawkish scholars in academia, Yan Xuetong, came out with a long article saying that, you know, we cannot decouple. The U.S.-China relationship is very important, and the academic exchange have to be a part of that. And he sort of really, it was a kind of a very strong statement of how important that is, and we shouldn't lose that in these sort of perilous times. Our friend Scott Kennedy at CSIS came out with a kind of a, what do you call it, a white paper, I guess you could say.
Manifesto?
not a manifesto, a white paper. It's like different scholars sort of, entered into the contributed articles. Wang Jisi, right? Jessica Chen Weiss, Mary Gallagher, Deborah Seligson, Xie Tao of Beiwei, Stephen R. Platt, all singing the same song, which is, whatever we do, we've got to get more Americans, more foreigners here in China. We've got to keep the academic exchange going, or it's going to be very, very turbulent waters ahead of us when we have these crises and there's no one on either side that knows anyone else and knows who to contact and how to resolve the crisis, right? So having said all that, and there are many other things I could talk about, this is a good sign, I think. I think it's not that any of these pronouncements or any of these programs are going to succeed in the goals that they proclaim, but it is a show that people are aware of this on both sides. And no matter what happens at the top level, at the geopolitical level of the U.S.-China relationship, the people in academia at both sides are very much still dedicated to this academic exchange process, and are willing to put their name on it, money behind it, and their time and attention to it. And I think that's hopeful. These few weeks I've been more hopeful about that particular kvetching problem that we had through these years than I have been since COVID. So it feels like there's a sunlight, you know, ahead. But you know, it's going to be hard. But at least that's one issue that I feel there's some reason to be optimistic.
I think that's all true, and I think there is some reason to be optimistic because of those things. But I think it's also true that for every professor or academic who is committed to the process of academic openness, intellectual exchange, people-to-people contact on a scholarly level, and all of that, the reality is that universities, academic institutions, like most institutions in China today, are increasingly subject to the dictates, the anxieties, the foibles, insecurities, hang-ups, and paranoia of the party officials.
Right.
And that's not just true in China. That's also something we're seeing in the United States as these kinds of relationships, as these kinds of programs become increasingly politicized
right.
on campuses. And so I think it is perfectly... I think it's perfectly valid to be optimistic about the future when we're talking about the number of people who are clearly aware that this is a problem. But most of those people are faculty. You know, there's a few people you mentioned, they're administrators, but they're administrators who are, let's just say, in the twilight of their career.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is that, yes, Xi Jinping wants 50,000 students to come here. They want to do programs in which they take students all around. They want to show them all of China.
Mm-hmm.
They want to take them to Tibet and yeah. Xinjiang. And they want to be sure that China's story is told well.
Right.
And to do that, they definitely don't need people like you. And they certainly don't need someone like me. Not that I would necessarily have a different story, because in all the classes I've ever taught here, the Chinese government or official perspective has always been a central part, I wouldn't say central, but it's also always been a major part of my syllabus. But I'm also the kind of annoying historian who likes to bring in alternative perspectives that may not be represented in official narratives. And there was a certain tolerance for that maybe 10 years ago. But now the idea of let's take the students to Tibet and let's talk about how the Chinese government and the party, and to be fair, many people in China see this issue. Let's talk about what Tibetan writers have said about this issue. And that, I suspect, is not what these programs are going to be.
Yeah.
So what kind, I mean, reasons to be optimistic? Absolutely. And I am optimistic for the same reasons you are. I'm not trying to pour cold, fizzy water in anybody's head. I'm not saying that it invalidates all mm-hmm. of these things. I just think that there's a part of this, which is what kind of programs are going to be on offer
mm-hmm.
when exchanges happen. And I'll be honest, I think that there are a lot of headwinds blowing both west and east
mm-hmm.
that's keeping these exchanges from happening. And I don't see at the moment, at least in 2024,
mm-hmm.
that changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
But there are students coming back. There are people right. who are coming here. Let's right. see how many programs come in this summer. That's yeah. always yeah. a good sign.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said. I think the caveat of all my optimism there is that the people who come, whether it be faculty or students, have to be sort of geared towards a new normal, as you were saying, you know, as that we were not only tolerated back in the early 2000s with those programs you and I were teaching. It was not just toleration. It was just that they left us alone. They never even asked. They didn't even care about what we were teaching.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell.
We don't show them our syllabus, and they didn't.
That's right.
They didn't ask what it was.
As long as you pay for the rooms and whatever that is the whatever the contract says, then they're happy with it. So yes, it will be a new normal. And there's a couple of things that are maybe workarounds or things that would still make all this very feasible. One thing is that I'm already feeling it because I've been trying to do recruiting and meeting with students, former students and students that are contact me. It's kind of interesting because the programs we were teaching at, probably most of the students there, the American students, were kind of there just out of curiosity and have fun and to do the kinds of things study abroad was usually about, you know, was just getting away from your family and school and having fun in a foreign country, right? partying and stuff like that. But there were always a certain percentage of people sitting there in the classroom that were very serious about China, already knew a lot, had already read a lot about it, and knew that they wanted to do something, and that's why they applied for this program. What I'm feeling now is the interest I see is 100% almost those kinds of people who are going to figure out a way to come here no matter what. And they also are not so stupid or sort of ignorant to not know that, in fact, this academic freedom is a problem here. So they are not, will not be surprised and maybe not even too upset if they find out they have to do a lot of the research that they want to do on their own. That's one thing, you know. And then the other thing, of course, is that it's just, as you sort of pointed out, it's good to just have boots on the ground here, because in some way the real education is not the courses that the kids are in, you know, for just a couple hours, 3 hours a week, and the Chinese courses that they learn a few characters and go home and forget it. The thing up here, the important aspect of being here in person is boots on the ground, seeing the reality of China, seeing what it's really like, and especially meeting Chinese people. And I don't know if CIE had this, or IES had roommates, I think they did. So the roommates was a big part of our program, right? The students, the American students, would actually live in the same dorm room with another Chinese person. And that kind of relationship is really formative and really interesting, and it's life-changing sometimes, and maybe not in a good way.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. And I think I've said this on this podcast before, and if not, I've certainly said it in other venues. I'm committed to the idea of study abroad.
Right.
And, you know, I've enjoyed teaching, and I'd like to think that I imparted some minor amount of information and wisdom to students over the years. But I was a study abroad student. I've worked with, you know, at this point, thousands of study abroad students. And I know that just as you just said, study abroad, the value, what people remember 15, mm-hmm. 20 years right. from now, is not probably the class on late imperial Chinese history. It's the time when you and your roommates all went out and did karaoke till 5 a.m. and you met those three gangsters at the karaoke right. thing. And, you know, the fact that you're now WeChat buddies with right. elder brother Wong, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Not to actually tell one of my students' yeah. stories. But that's the takeaway. And I also think, too, we've talked about this in terms of the comparison between short-term and long-term programs. Damn, man, like it's the first step off the plane. That's the win.
Yeah.
I know that there's a qualitative difference to being here for a semester or a year versus a summer versus 3 weeks. I get that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's getting off the plane. And being immersed in that environment, just that's the first step, and that's the most important step.
Yeah.
And the more students that we can get in both directions that make that first meaningful step, that's great. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think we are reverting to a certain norm where it's the China geeks. It's people like you and me. And I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. These are our people.
Right.
But also from the hard reality of what makes these programs tick, mm-hmm. they need numbers.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
Those numbers, I have no expectation that they're going to see the numbers that many of these programs are banking on. Mm-hmm. IES, CIEE, yeah.
right.
CET, all of these different study abroad programs, and the university offices, and the Chinese programs
yeah.
we're counting on. And of course, several of the programs that I just named are either no longer existent or will soon no longer be existent.
Yeah, or on hold for who knows how long.
Or indefinite hold,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the problems now, or the problem right now, is China's image. It's not China per se that people are reticent about, you know. It's the image that's on the TV and the mass media. That's not likely to change. China's image is not going to change very much in the foreseeable future. But we're talking about a different kind of a channel here. If you can get the programs going, get some people here, have an interesting experience, come back and can relate to their study abroad office or other students or something, that, yeah, it's cool, it's interesting, it's not what you think, it's worth going if you're interested at all in a future, not necessarily a job, since those are also drying up a little bit, but just for intrinsic value. And there are still no small amount of people, academic nerds, that just want to continue to study China for reasons for economic reasons, just to understand how geopolitics works, or because they're just taken with the things that we find cool about China, the history, philosophy, all these things. So, I mean, the trick is just to get that channel flowing again. And how many are going to be in there? It's not as much as can never probably reach the peak at the Beijing Olympics that we had in 2008. But if we can just get a trickle or a, you know, a stream here, then that's all worthwhile. And the future over shells and Susan Shirks will come. Right now, the thing our ambassador Burns was bemoaning was last year there were only 350 students or something in China. And the thought of where is this next generation of China hands going to come from? So I'm really more concerned about that and not, you know, trying to recreate this flood of curiosity and interest that caused the higher numbers prior to 2008. Anyway, we've gone on too long. We're back in this kvetching mode. Let's go back to the talk about the future of the podcast a little bit here.
Someday you'll have to define the word kvetching for me. And on a slightly unrelated note, I was 21 years old before I first had a bagel.
Well, at least you know it's a Jewish thing.
I grew up in New Hampshire. It wasn't entirely clear. It probably came out of a plastic bag in a Demoulas supermarket.
I went when I was in Taiwan in the 80s. I saw a sort of a pastry shop, and it said bagels for sale. And it was I saw a little photo of a bagel with cream cheese. I went, wow, this is amazing. What a cross-cultural, you know, gold mine. And I just found, you know, I can get bagels and cream cheese in Taiwan. So I went and I ordered it. They came out, put it on my plate, on my table. It was a donut with whipped cream spread all over it.
Well, a shout out to my first Chinese history professor and the person who, if anyone's curious or wants revenge, responsible for kind of getting me into Chinese history, Dr. David Gedalicia of the College of Worcester. Dr. Gedalicia, who I think was then and perhaps even still is working on the world's first Yiddish to Chinese dictionary. He would often regale us with various linguistic and cultural similarities between his upbringing in New York and as a member of the Jewish community in New York and his experiences studying in Taiwan and doing research in Chinese history. So, kvetching bagels aside, that was a little digression there. Yeah, so let's talk about this. What does a podcast look like going forward? Because part of my goal for doing this podcast in the beginning was not just a narcissistic desire to have my voice amplified and broadcast to dozens of people, but also because I saw this as a natural outgrowth of what, you know, what we've been doing in our careers, which is trying to explain to get people to better understand China. Like you're talking about getting students to necessarily present it when they go back, present a picture of China. I've long said, and I this may come out harsh, but bear with me. I've told people I don't care if at the end of my class students like China. That's never been my goal, to get people to like China. It's never been my goal to get them to not like China.
Yeah.
That is irrelevant to
right.
me. All I wanted for them to understand China.
Right, right.
And the same thing with this podcast, good, bad,
right.
other, was to get people to better understand China. And it obviously evolved over the last 4 years to the point where we were, again, some of the few people broadcasting or recording from within China during COVID. So I think about what our mission should be going forward. And in an effort to kind of think about how this podcast can further evolve along with our own careers, I have some thoughts as to what we're going to be doing next. But David, I mean, you joined the podcast 4 years ago. We did an earlier version of this in like 2016, 2017. It really became what it is today when David joined during COVID. I'm just curious what you kind of see as what we're going to do next.
Hmm. Well, one thing that we have tended to treat it somewhat like a current events news kind of, you know, anything that's certainly during COVID, we were always giving updates about the COVID crisis because that seemed to be what everyone was most curious about. I think in the next period, there will certainly be events, kerfuffles that need to be mentioned or talked about or might be interesting. But I think we should utilize mostly your talents. I don't have these. I'm sort of what my Chinese friends call me a zajia, a kind of a
dilettante.
Yeah, dilettante. That's the word. That's what I'm looking for. It's zajia, right? Of course, it sounds like a compliment, which is saying, "Oh, you're sort of a master of everything."
Renaissance man sounds better.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I should teach them that. Renaissance man, right? But I think that we have a lot of our own personal experiences to draw upon, and there's so many other nooks and crannies of Chinese history, recent history, Chinese culture, things that I used to love to tell my students about. But when I lost my students because they can't come or don't want to come, then I sort of lost touch with those amazing things about China, the changes that happened during the 90s and the early 2000s and what it was like then. The aspects of Chinese culture that you and I that are longstanding are you know, ancient aspects of China that are still cool, interesting, delightful, puzzling, confounding. Those are the things really that I really loved doing and being a bridge. Think of myself as a bridge, and I certainly think of you as a bridge, who are able to go in both directions, to talk to Americans about what China is like, but also to talk to Chinese people about what America is like, or give them a truer picture of America. So I think that there's a lot to be mined there for both of us, I think, and we can take, you know, bits and pieces that have to do with culture, history, and sort of weave them in. It doesn't have to be a full podcast with a formal interview and you know, this sorts of thing. What do you think?
Well, I also think a bridge is something stuck in the mud that people walk all over, but sure, bridge. And I'd like to see the podcast kind of develop in this way too, that we keep a lot of what we've done before, which is we still talk to people, particularly people from academia, because I do feel like there's a lot of experts out there who have written these amazing books that, because of the nature of academia, and no, it's no reflection on their talent as researchers, it's just the way scholarship works, 19 people are going to read it.
Right. It's a star system, just like Hollywood, right? There may be a great movie, but only a few people watch it on Netflix. But, you know, I want to name, we don't need to name names, people whose books get reviewed everywhere, and then great books that fall by the wayside that are equally interesting. Yeah.
Or that, frankly, are also just academic monographs and might not be of... as accessible for the non-specialist. I like the idea of talking to folks, right, and having them talk about their research, because in a way that also brings it to, you know, again, the dozens of people, right, who listen to us. So I find value to that. I don't necessarily think that's location dependent.
Right.
I think also the reality is that I may be moving on, but you are, for the foreseeable future, stuck here, and I think we should take advantage of that.
Mm. Stuck here?
Sorry. You are, for the foreseeable future, carrying on as a hero of socialist labor in the great motherland.
Happily, gloriously, ecstatically.
With my heart singing. So there's that.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think I'd like to do as well is to expand some of what we do. And so starting in the next couple of months, we're going to be doing the podcast as people have come to know them. We're also going to be doing, in between the regular episodes, shorter, more information-based episodes. And we want to take advantage of David's being very, very modest when he talks about his, what is it, Zaja?
Renaissance man.
Renaissance person. That He David is, of course, well known for his writing and his expertise on linguistics in general, and Chinese linguistics and the history of Mandarin in particular. I have a background of sorts in history. And so I thought what we could do is we would interpolate the regular episodes with more shorter and hopefully kind of interesting information-based episodes, where David or I are going to tackle a particular question or topic, either as a duo or as an individual. And in my case, I want to, thinking about our actual name of our podcast, which I don't even remember exactly why I chose it, Barbarians at the Gate, I'm going to be talking a lot about the intersection between the rest of the world and China in all of its different permutations over the years. You know, it could be everybody from Marco Polo to Israel Epstein to Lord McCartney. I just want to talk about
Edmund Backus,
Ellen Lamott, you know, all kinds of different figures who have come through in some way. And also, you know, thinking going the other way as well. There are plenty of people from China. You know, one of the people I research is a guy named Chung Ho, who was certainly worthy of a podcast, as he was China's least fortunate diplomat in the 19th century. Stay tuned to find out why. And I was thinking in that line, David, is there some aspect or questions that you might be willing to tackle in the same way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think I sort of mentioned some of them. The evolution of the media, for example. I mean, I'm very obsessed, very interested in media and how the information controller works and how it's evolved from the 80s until the present time. There's a lot to be said about that. There's a lot of historical information that frankly, most people don't really know about. Most people kind of assume the internet came here about the same time as it did in the West. That's one broad topic that has lots of historical... I'd love to do a show on just talking about the evolution and the fate of Weibo, which is a fascinating study of how a platform was born, became huge, exploded into a very successful social media network that turned into a very threatening social media network for various reasons, and how they defanged it. That whole story is fascinating. That kind of thing. I mean, I'd love to talk about it. I love language, so there are lots to talk about language. There's a lot to talk about how it's evolving. I might even do a show or even have a Beijinger come in and talk about the new Beijing slang that sort of thing is fun and easy and short and usually interesting to language buffs, language nerds. So things like that.
Well, nerds in general, just language nerds.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's be inclusive here. All nerds. So I think that is going to be our plan going forward. We're going to do episodes like this. We'll do episodes where we talk to some of our favorite writers, thinkers, scholars, and then we're also going to be giving our listeners these shorter podcasts that are going to be a little bit more information-based. And we hope you find those very interesting. If you have a suggestion, if you have a particular question you'd like David or I to address, and it's somewhere within our information wheelhouse, please, by all means, you can hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Twitter. Shit, what's my name? At Jeremiah Jenny on Twitter. David is at David.
_Moser.
David _Moser.
Right.
And you can always hit us up that way. You can also, I'm going to be redesigning or actually designing a podcast landing page that will include our contact information on it as well. So we'll be trying to make this a little bit more interactive, although we've always appreciated all the questions and comments thinly veiled and sometimes not so thinly veiled threats that we've received over the years. So keep those coming, of course, but we want to also open it up to anyone who would like to perhaps suggest a topic. And I've got a couple ideas coming for the next few months, and I know David does as well. Well, David, I got a plane to catch.
Okay. Out you go. Bon voyage.
And cue the drums.